these guys here are world-class mushers that they're all doing the same thing. They're running their teams the best that their teams can do. So I got a game plan moving forward, and I just hope to be finishing a good spot.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else the Iditarod and Iditarod mushers doing the best with what they've got. And what they've got are some pretty awesome sled dogs. I'm your host, Casey Grove, a mere human. I think I'd really enjoy being a dog, though, maybe in another life. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. That was Ryan Reddington, a production of Reddington Racing, son of Ramey Reddington, who ran the first Iditarod, leading off today. It's Friday from where I'm standing anyway, and currently leading in the 50th running of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race is Brent Sass, the three-time Yukon Quest champ, aiming for his first Iditarod win. And Sass's team was the first to mush onto the Yukon River, pulling into the Athabascan village of Ruby with 13 dogs around 6 a.m. Our reporter on the trail, Lex Trinan, was there up early along with a few dozen people, including race officials, other news media, and local fans who came out to watch in single-digit temperatures. Lex tells me the Northern Lights, a.k.a. the Aurora Borealis, were dancing over the river in the sky above everyone, so that's a nice treat. And as the first musher to the Yukon River, if he had wanted to stop, Sass would have been treated to $3,500 cash in $1 bills, so like a bundle of cash. And that would have been sitting next to him while he was served a bottle of champagne Dom Pérignon and a five-course gourmet meal cooked up by chefs who fly in for the occasion. I say would have, could have, I'm not going to say should have, because Sass wanted to mush on and declined the meal.
Really good to see you. I wish I could stay, but
yeah, I know
my schedule doesn't allow it. It's cold.
Yeah,
gotta take advantage of it.
The meal, in case you were wondering, and I was, I'll just read straight from the Iditarod press release about this. It consists of an appetizer of pan-seared blackened shrimp served with mango chutney and cucumber. To warm up the musher from the trail, a reindeer minestrone soup with crostini bread follows the starter. Next is an iceberg wedge lettuce salad served with bacon, apple, blue cheese crumbles, and dried cranberries. The entree is an 8-ounce seared beef tenderloin wrapped in bacon with sides of asparagus, baby carrots, fingerling potatoes, and a red wine mushroom sauce. For dessert, a trio cheesecake bar with strawberry sauce. I got gradually more smarmy as that went on. But Sass, for sure, he knew that warmer temperatures during the daytime would be more taxing on the dogs. Plus, he had already rested the team for a few hours on the trail about a dozen miles outside of Ruby, so they were poised to make the 50-mile run down the Yukon from Ruby to the next checkpoint, and that's Galena. As he was grabbing extra fuel for that run, Sass said the hilly spruce forest trail that he'd come in on from Cripple was in great condition.
The whole trail was awesome. Yeah, it was the best trail of the race so far, I'd say.
At the time, Sass's closest competition, Hugh Neff, was about 15 miles still outside of Ruby, and Dallas Seavey was resting on the trail about 20 miles from the checkpoint. They've since made it to Ruby. Sass and Dallas Seavey have made it out of the Ruby checkpoint by now, and I'll update the race standings here in a little bit, but first let's go back to the Cripple checkpoint, the one before Ruby, because that is where Lex was yesterday when he had a little bit more time to talk to those front runners. That's when and where they were finishing their mandatory 24-hour breaks. Here is Lex.
Mushers' puffy faces and droopy eyelids had faded slightly on Thursday afternoon as five mushers trudged around the snow machine paths in the dogyard in Cripple. A northwest wind blew through the spruce forest as they tended their sleds and dogs. The mood was warm and light, though. Veteran musher Hugh Neff was cheery as he jokes about listening in on conversations of his bunkmates like Dallas and Mitch Seavey.
Usually most of what's coming out of their mouths is half-truths and soliloquies, so I try not to get too involved with talking to mushers unless it's after the race and we're having a beer.
They weren't drinking beers, at least not yet. They'd raced for four straight days with only a few hours of sleep until Cripple, where the five of them decided to take the 24-hour rest that all teams must make at some point along the trail. They say even though they're in a race, they're still all friendly, sharing stories, and sharing supplies. Neff, who's coming back from the Iditarod after getting banned a few years ago, says he's not surprised to be towards the front of his powerhouse team. He's had to drop a few dogs, but says his all-female team is still running strong.
Like I've been telling people, it's a women's world, and these girls are kicking my butt. I mean, I've wiped out probably 7 times so far.
Despite the good humor, mushers were also working diligently to keep their dogs in top shape, massaging sore muscles, and dishing out plentiful bowls of meaty broth. It's something the 5 of them share, says Ryan Reddington, as he heated water on an aluminum stove next to his sled.
These guys here are world-class mushers that they're all doing the same thing. They're running their teams the best that their teams can do. So I got a game plan moving forward, and I just hope to be finishing a good spot.
He says so far his dogs are eating well and he didn't have any serious injuries. He's looking forward to making it to Unalakleet, where he has some family members. Brent Sass, the first musher to leave the Cripple Checkpoint, says he's happy with how his team's running too, but he has one minor concern.
They could be eating a little better. They're eating enough and they're eating their food, but I'd like to see a team get up and like chow down their food. So I think right now our strong suit is just that they're steady. You know, that's what I always say about my dog team is they're steady, and I think that they're going to kind of continue with that.
He says he was a little worried he'd have to break trail over the hilly spruce forest out of Cripple, but he's not worried about repeating his own history. Several years ago, Sass led to the Yukon River before falling back towards the end of the race. Now, he sports a forearm tattoo that reminds him not to get sucked into chasing his competition. It reads, "Run your own race."
I feel like that is a thing of the past. I have no anxiety about that at all.
A row down in the dogyard, Sass's biggest competition, Dallas Seavey, also has some concerns about his dogs. He says that because of the deep snow and a minor illness running through his team, he's been rotating rest dogs in his tow sled, which drags behind the sled he steers.
And so we've definitely been off our normal pace. I think that if we get over this, they'll be ready to rock and roll. This is still one heck of a dog team, and I'm feeling pretty pleased.
He's also been putting in extra time in the dogyard in Cripple, making sure his ill dogs are eating as much as they can. Between that and the distractions of the muster's cabin, he hasn't been sleeping quite as much as he'd like.
And that some people can really snore out here, there's no doubt about that.
CV, who's vying for a record-setting 6th Iditarod win, said that this year's Iditarod could be his last, but he's not putting too much pressure on himself.
Usually when you have to make those choices to slow down or take extra rest, there's a little bit of a twinge of, you know, like, man, we should be racing or something. And this year it's like, we're having fun. The dogs are happy. That's all that matters. And if anything, the pressure is to make sure we have a fun one.
Besides, he says he's not even thinking about the competition until Caltag, about 200 miles up the trail. Reporting in Cripple, I'm Lex Trennan.
That's what those front-running mushers were talking about in the Cripple Checkpoint. And like I said, I want to update those race standings now. Brent Sass out of Ruby, and just looking at the Iditarod.com GPS tracker, as I'm recording this, he is approaching the Galena checkpoint. He will surely be arriving there very soon. Dallas Seavey is mushing on the Yukon River as well, and he's about 30 miles or so behind Brent Sass at the moment. And it looks like everyone else who by now has arrived in Ruby is still in Ruby. That would be Hugh Neff in 3rd place, Jesse Holmes in 4th, Richie Deal in 5th. I'm going to mention him again in a second. Ryan Reddington, who we just heard from, in 6th. Aaron Burmeister in 7th. That's everybody that's in Ruby at the moment. And then approaching the Ruby checkpoint is Mitch Seavey. Then you have Mille Porcild. It looks like in 9th at the moment, still on the run between Cripple and Ruby. Travis Beals in 10th. And Michelle Phillips a little bit behind him. We've also had a second musher to scratch from the race. That's Two Rivers dog driver Ryan Olson. She has pulled out of the race with 9 dogs, and that was at about 5 p.m. Thursday. And as the race officials often say, she did that in the best interest of her team. So I noted Richie Deal's name earlier because people are looking for one of his dogs, actually. Not on the trail, mind you. One of the dogs Richie had to drop earlier in the race is now missing in Anchorage after escaping from the returned dog area at the Lakefront Anchorage Hotel. That's also who sent the chefs out there to cook the meal, by the way. And it's the race headquarters. At least it still is this year. They've actually announced that they're going to pull their race sponsorship next year. Anyway, race officials say that this missing dog's name is Jimbo. And Jimbo got away around 7:15 yesterday morning. That's 7:15 a.m. Thursday during a routine check by a race veterinarian. If you're in Anchorage and you see a sled dog running around, Jimbo has dark and white coloring, more dark on his back and lighter on his chest. It's kind of all mixed together, though. Dark fur on his face that's kind of wrapped around white cheeks. I suppose there's a little bit of light brown in there as well. Don't take my word for it, though. We have a picture of Jimbo at alaskapublic.org. Jimbo's also wearing a red collar with a tag that says Iditarod number 18, if you get that close. But this is important. Race officials say people should not try to approach or catch Jimbo. He might just keep running, and we don't want him to get hit by a car. So please report any sightings by calling 907-248-MUSH. That's 907-248-6874. MUSH. The race has also notified police and area animal shelters, and we're told Jimbo is microchipped. So definitely we hope everything turns out okay for Jimbo. Maybe he's on his way over to be our dog of the day. Well, for now, our dog of the day is going to be from the team of the aforementioned Ryan Olson. He's coming off the trail now, hopefully to a secure area. But let's turn our magnifying glass on to Sherlock.
So one of the dogs that's going to be on the race this year is a 2-year-old, and his name is Sherlock, and he's the biggest dog that I've ever had. He's 76 pounds, which is huge for an Alaskan Husky, but he brings a lot of power. He's not super speedy, so a soft, slow trail will definitely benefit him. And he's just a big doofus. He makes you smile every day, super playful, excited for literally everything. He will pop my snow hook in a heartbeat because he doesn't like to stop for longer than a few seconds. And he just brings so much energy and joy to the team that I couldn't leave him at the kennel. So this will be his first Iditarod, and I'm excited to see how he does. And I think he's going to have a great time.
And where's the name Sherlock from?
So he has a brother named Watson, Sherlock and Watson. So I'm guessing everyone can think of that theme. But I would not say he would not be a very good detective. He's not the sharpest tool in the shed.
So I take it he's not a leader?
No, he's definitely not a leader. And sometimes if there's a tree that is like a slightly weird shape that's coming up, he'll kind of look at it and like bark at it and be like, "What is that over there?" So yeah, no, he is not the one that will be leading the team down the trail.
Okay, maybe not the sharpest, but hey, it takes all kinds of dogs to get down that trail to Nome. And you can find Sherlock and our other dog profiles at alaskapublic.org. Personally, one of my favorite parts of covering this race is getting to know all the different dogs and their different personalities, their different stories. I still can't get over Kaylin Davis's dog Zeke, who the last we heard was leading her team. I had a dream about our old family dog Jack the night before I heard that story. And then getting the update that Zeke had been coming through as a leader on Davis's team just made me so proud for all of the rescued former shelter dogs out there in the world. I just instantly remembered when my mom and I went to get Jack from the pound when I was about 5 years old, and he was in the cage, like jumping higher than I was tall. He was so excited to get out of there. Jack was pretty sharp, not always the best behaved dog. And as my Aunt Stacy, an Iditapod listener and former Iditapod question asker, as she said about Jack, he was being the best dog he knew how to be. Which I think is a great way to think about it. Okay, before I start getting all misty-eyed, and speaking of Kaylin Davis, we're going to hear from her again now. That's because our other trail reporter, Jeff Chen, heard an interesting story about Davis teaming up with her fellow women Iditarod mushers, Yuka Honda from Japan, and Fairbanks's Lisbet Norris. Davis, Honda, and Norris, working together, fought their way through a serious snowstorm on the way to McGrath. Here's Jeff.
Just before noon on Thursday, the last three dog teams to make it to McGrath arrived at the same time. Lisbet Norris, then Yuka Honda, then Kaylin Davis. The trio had become fast friends out on the trail. For more than 50 miles, Davis says, they weathered a storm together.
The first half was like just blowing snow and the wind. You couldn't really see anything.
The trail and the non-trail looked the same. But it was easy to tell when they got off the trail because they would sink into hip-deep snow. So the three teams took turns navigating.
And then once we found the trail, then we had to break the trail.
After 9 hours and traveling just 35 miles, they decided to stop and camp until they were ready to make the final push to McGrath. Davis says it was the first time they all traveled together, and she's happy they did.
It was good. I mean, 3 full teams of sled dogs, and you're in stressful conditions and passing each other and being passed, and like none of the dogs were grumpy, and they're all still pretty happy and really friendly with each other, so it was great.
The teams parked their dogs close to each other at the checkpoint. As far as any lessons learned on the trail,
don't run a dinner run again. it was a really good idea to caravan. I'm glad we left together.
The 3 mushers then settled in to rest in McGrath, about a third of the race behind them. Honda heats up an ointment for a dog that has diarrhea, and Davis gets ready to help apply it.
I don't know which job is worse, mine or yours.
In McGrath, I'm Jeff Chen.
Sorry, doggy.
Yikes. That's all I'm going to say about that. Maybe that outro will generate some questions from you listeners. If it did, or if you have other questions about the Iditarod and dog mushing, please say that you do have other questions. Send those on in. The best way to do that is to record a voice memo of yourself, tell us your name and where you are, ask that question, and then send it to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And that's what these fine folks did with their question about necklines, and specifically why, after Girdwood musher Nick Petit had to bow out right before the race due to a positive COVID test, that 4-time Iditarod champ Jeff King of Denali would be a good choice to mush Nick's dogs.
Hi, this is Andy from Rainbow, California.
Bob from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hi, my name's Kira Winstrom, and I'm listening from Mount Lake Terrace in Washington.
I saw an interview this week with Nick Petit.
On the Iditarod Insider.
On the Insider, about why he'd asked Jeff King
to run his dogs. And Nick mentioned that he didn't run his dogs with necklines, and Jeff didn't either.
He said that one of the reasons why he chose Jeff King to run his dogs was because Jeff has experience running dogs with no necklines.
He felt like Jeff King would be able to manage a team that didn't use a neckline.
I was wondering if you could tell us what necklines are.
Can you explain what necklines are and the pros and cons of using them?
I know what a neckline is, but I really have no idea why running a team with neckline versus without it would be different.
Why some mushers use them and why Nick and Jeff do not.
Wondering if you guys can find out a little bit about that. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate the podcast.
Hey, we appreciate you too. Thanks for listening along. I was just emailing with Andy, who, as it turns out, is a military judge and a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. So, you know, we clearly have some very esteemed listeners here. Andy, whose whole office is apparently hooked now on the Iditarod, signed off her email with Semper Fi. Semper Fidelis to you too, Andy. Not sure about any ranks or titles for Kira or Bob, but they also had that same good question, which is one that I needed somebody to explain to me too. So we went straight to the source.
My name's Nick Petit. I run my dogs without necklines. First, it started off because they just ate the things and I got tired of replacing them. And then I'd put the ones that chewed all this stuff up in the front because there's less stuff to chew in front. And then more would get chewed, and I'd put them behind that. And little by little, I ended up with no necklines. Once in a while, I put them on the wheel dogs just to make sure that they don't miss a step and might end up under the sled or something. But that's how I started doing it. And what I see from it is, ask yourself, if you were on a team, would you like to be connected at the neck and pull from a different point? Or would you like to have some freedom in where you step? That's really all it is. Put yourself in their position. So there's 2 points of connection for a dog on a dog team. Well, 3 points, you know, the mental one. But the physical connection is the tug line goes to the rear of the dog where it's connected to the harness and the dog is pulling. So that one, you kind of got to have it on unless you're stopped, in which case you shouldn't have it on because the dog should be able to just mill around and point any direction it really wants while it's resting. Now, while they're going down the trail, you do need them pointed the right way. So even when you stop on the trail, you need them to still point the right way. And so that's the toughest part about training these dogs, is I have to remind them, point the right direction. Don't come back over here and say hi to your buddy, because that's going to cause a knot. So it's not for everyone. It takes some eyes behind the back of your head type of stuff. But once you get them figured out and you know how to do it, it's so much easier. Picture anytime there's a tangle and you have necklines that are pieces of metal. Every time you're in a tangle and those things are slightly frozen, you have to battle that. Instead, there's no metal on my gang line. And so there's no buildup of ice preventing me from taking a dog off the line as quick as possible. If you're in a tangle, you got to be able to let him loose, or not loose, but disconnect whatever points are connected as quickly as possible to prevent further tangle and injury. So I run without necklines. A lot of people wouldn't want to ever try. And some mushers would say that everybody should have a neckline, but my dog team's okay. It's all about teaching them to behave. Then you got to be passed by the dog team sometimes, and your dogs have to give the right of way. And if they go and cross over the trail and tangle up with the other team, nobody's happy. So we just, it's all about patience and teaching the dogs to just point the right way for their own protection.
Interesting. And thanks to Nicholas Petit for that answer, and our Tegan Hanlon for wrangling it, along with all of our online content at alaskapublic.org, Iditarod, or otherwise. It sounds like not only is that something that dogs need to be somewhat trained for, to have a little extra freedom like that, it's also something the mushers might need to be used to if the dogs already are. So it makes sense that if Jeff King is familiar with running dogs without necklines, that he would be a good fit for Nicholas Petit's team, which is used to not running with necklines. Okay, so that was today's listener question with a musher answer. But how about a listener question with a listener answer? Here's another esteemed listener, a postdoctoral fellow, Dr. Abby, which makes me think we might need to call this Ask Dr. Abby.
Hi, Iditapod. I'm Abby from Michigan, and I am a physicist and astronomer, so I wanted to figure out the number of watts per sled dog that was asked a couple episodes ago. So I did a bunch of math, and what I figured out is that the short version is that if you want to go from 0 to 10 miles an hour, it is about 650 watts per dog if it's distributed evenly. And then to keep going at a constant 10 miles an hour, it's about 80 watts per dog. But there, of course, are some like assumptions that we made in there. So I just picked 10 miles an hour as a team because that seemed to be a speed that some of the more competitive mushers were going at. I also assumed that each dog was pulling 80 pounds of sled weight and that each dog was 60 pounds. These are just assumptions that you kind of have to make to get there. And I was also assuming that this is fully distributed evenly among all the dogs, but we all know that's not quite true because wheel dogs end up pulling a lot more to get the sled started from zero. But this 80 watts per dog to keep it going at a constant speed, this is just to counteract the friction of the snow on the sled. And so this is why, as was talked about a few episodes ago, it's so important to use good like runner plastic and to maybe like wax the runners so that way you can minimize the friction so that there's less work that the dogs have to do to keep the sled going fast. Yeah, thanks. I love the podcast. Bye.
Yeah, the coefficient of sliding friction, maybe, if I remember correctly from my days as a failing high school physics student. Part of why I got into journalism. Thanks for that answer, though, Dr. Abby. I'm glad somebody qualified to answer that question reached out, because whatever that calculation was that I came up with in episode 3 was way off. Probably so far off, I'm not even going to go back and listen to what it was. But if you want to, all of the episodes from our 6 seasons of Iditapod should be in your podcast feeds. They're also at alaskapublic.org, along with a whole bunch of photos, other stories, our dogs of the day, and more. We will continue to update you on the race there. I think we'll be back tomorrow with another episode of the Iditapod. I still want to hear from those chefs about how they felt that Brent just blew through the checkpoint and didn't eat the meal. It's probably okay. We might have a bonus episode soon, too, with an interview from before the race. That's Hannah Lyric or Lyric, and probably should figure out how to pronounce her name by then. Currently, she is the top rookie out there in the 2022 Iditarod. We shall see, though. We are doing the best with what we've got. In the meantime, keep an eye out for Jimbo, will ya? Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. Thanks, as always, to the rest of the Iditapod team, Tegan Hanlon, Lex Trinan, and Jeff Chen. And thank you to you for listening. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Our town pet moose.
You got a contract moose?
Our town pet moose, yeah. It used to stay down there across the creek from our postmaster. She lives in that house across the creek. And it used to stay down there for like a month or month and a half. And then it moved back there to across from Prantis's.
What's his name?
I had no name.
It
doesn't have a name.
It's going to be you someday,
but
yeah?
I always called it Dorothy's moose. Until it moves, so now maybe it's Jenny's moose. She's our city clerk.